3 minutes. share with you.
So good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for being here. I want to begin by welcoming all of you to the Utilities Roundtable. I'm Senator Lisa McGuire. My district is Senate District N here in Southwest Anchorage. There are a few of us that are going to speak today. The agenda hopefully is on the back there, and you can see I'm going to turn to Marilyn Leland next, who's, of course, the Executive Director of the Alaska Power Association. I want to acknowledge first the lawmakers that are here today. We have Senator Cliff Bishop. We're lucky to have him from Fairbanks today. Senator Huggins on his way. Senator Bryce Edgman, who is on the line, and Senator Isaacson, who is on as well. Representative Garen Tarr just came in, and I also want to acknowledge RCA Commissioner Norm Roeckberg, who's also a constituent as well, who's here in the room. So we're here today. This is a follow-up. This issue, just looking at it from 35,000 feet, has come to many of us in the legislature. And so I have taken on a leadership role in trying to facilitate discussions about it during the interim. And that's the issue of how independent power producers may be able to provide power here in the state of Alaska. And so the first roundtable that was organized was to allow their perspective to come forward, to allow them to discuss the challenges that they have felt in offering that independent power production through the last few years across the state of Alaska. At that time, I announced the fact that, of course, we would have a utilities roundtable to have that perspective, and that is what we're doing here today. The discussion is an important one for the future of the state. We have the highest cost of energy, as we all know, of any state in the union, and those states are, those costs are borne out by not only the residents, but the commercial consumers that are unable to compete at a level that certainly would provide more jobs and more economic opportunities here for Alaskans. So we know it's a complex issue that utilities are regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska for the benefit of the consumer. And I want to reemphasize that that is something that is always foremost on my mind. At the same time, would it be good for the consumer to introduce some more competition? Would it be good to introduce more opportunities for different sources of power that would create redundancy or affordability? There are federal laws, which I know will be a part of the presentations up here, federal laws pertaining to independent power production. Generally speaking, in Alaska, the federal laws are not something that are written in a way, you look at No Child Left Behind and other things that usually apply to Alaskans. We always end up in a place where we're carving out individual solutions. So we recognize that, and that's the point of today's hearing. Nothing that we do as lawmakers would be meant to reduce the affordability of electricity in the state, the reliability, the consumer opportunities that we have, but a hope that we could have would be that Alaskans would pay some of the lower rates, that high energy prices would not continue to constrain economic development, and that we could all look as Alaskans toward different solutions. So I invite you all to open your mind today and try not to enter this with a presumed paradigm that we are here in a state that's only 54 years old. It's exciting. We have a chance to do it differently. We have done that in the past. And so it may not look like PURPA. It may not look like some of the RCA regulations. It may not be, quote, pro-utility or pro-independent power producer, but maybe it's a different paradigm that we can think about that welcomes a different solution for the future. So I thank you all. I'm going to turn it over at this point to Marilyn Leland. She is just a wonderful human being. She was a part of our energy plan that we produced in 2009. She, along with Mira Kohler, who will also speak on the agenda, led the consumer-driven portion of writing the energy policy for the state of Alaska. So I turn it to Marilyn, the director of the Alaska Power Association.
Thank you, Senator, and we're going to be sharing the microphone here, and I just want to check with the folks that are on the the teleconference can hear, since the Polycom is over there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Again, thank you, Senator. The Alaska Power Association appreciates the opportunity to co-host the second in a series of energy-related roundtable discussions. For those of you in the audience who may not be familiar with Alaska Power Association, we're the 62-year-old statewide trade association for the electric utilities in Alaska. APA members range in size from Chukotka Electric Association, which is, of course, Alaska's largest electric utility with more than 81,000 meters, down to Tenalian Electric Cooperative, and they only have 135 meters. Our 36 electric utility members span the state from Barrow to Kodiak and from Gamble to Metlakatla. They are electric cooperatives, municipal utilities, joint action agencies, and investor-owned utilities. And something the Senator and I were just talking about, I think it's important to note there too, is Alaska is about 90% public power. We also have a few telephone cooperatives who are our members, but our members provide power to the majority of Alaskans. So today's utility roundtable discussion provides a forum for Alaska Power Association members to discuss the challenges and opportunities of providing safe, reliable, and affordable electric power to Alaskans. Moreover, it provides a dialogue for electric utility managers and lawmakers to discuss Alaska's electric energy future. During the presentations that we're going to be having, you're going to receive a framework of our issues, a profile of our current energy picture, and a look at system operator and management models that are currently being explored by the railroad utilities. All of us who have been in this industry for many years know that there is no silver bullet on solving all of the challenges that we're going to be discussing today. And we know that what works in one region or what works for one utility may not work for another. And at the risk of sounding trite, one size really just does not fit all here in Alaska when it comes to energy solutions. But what we do know for certain is that the history of reliability, innovation, and stability of the Alaska electric utilities, they're dynamic, forward-thinking entities, and they have a very strong history. The utility decisions are driven by the needs of their customers to have reliable and affordable power for a stronger economy and ultimately for the sustainability of our state. After the three formal presentations, some of the APA member CEOs who are up here at the head table with us, I think they have a few comments that they would like to make on how their utilities are approaching their energy challenges. So again, Senator McGuire, I really appreciate this opportunity. I think maybe it would be good if we can just quickly maybe just go down as each person at the table can introduce themselves, and then we're going to go to Corey Borges for his presentation.
Sabrina,
would you like to start? And if people do need to use microphones.
Sabrina Wilbur, TDX Power.
Joe Griffith, MEA and architect.
Mira Kohler, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative.
Corey Borgeson, President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric.
Clint Bishop, Senate District C, Fairbanks.
Tim McLeod, CEO, Alaska Electric Light and Power, Juneau.
Jody Mitchell, Inside Passage Electric Cooperative.
Great, thank you all. And again, I think at this point we'll just go to Corey Borgeson, CEO of Golden Valley Electric, for his presentation.
Thank you very much, Marilyn, and thank you, Senator McGuire, for putting this opportunity together today. It's a pleasure to be here with this panel and the utility folks that are here, as well as all our constituents out in the audience. We're glad to be able to talk about the Utility Energy Roundtable topics here today. Mira Kohler is going to give you a very good kind of broad overview of what the utilities look like in Alaska. And Joe Griffith is going to talk some later on about what we're doing in the Rail Belt as far as trying to develop new systems and new ways of operating the Rail Belt transmission lines and what ArcTech is doing, which we think is very exciting. But I decided to kind of start off the presentation today with kind of some of the meat and some of the issues that we think we've got going with the independent power producers and how we can make things work together and how we can take synergy, things that Alaskans are so good about doing, and make something happen positive for everybody here in the state. So I want to talk, Senator McGuire mentioned the PURPA law, and I did want to bring it forward because I want to tell you that in 1978, the federal government passed a law that said utilities must purchase power from qualified facilities, independent power producers, at a price that's just and reasonable and in the public interest. And utilities can't discriminate against the qualified facilities. I kind of complained to my folks about that picture. It looked like it's from the 60s, but actually that's 1978, David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen. So that is a 78 picture. But, you know, when we talk about how we do things here in Alaska, you know, we do have federal laws that impose requirements and restrictions on us in Alaska. Some of the laws that the other states in the contiguous 48 face don't face us here because of the interstate commerce provisions. But we have federal laws, including PURPA, that affect us here. And under the state, we have the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And in 1978 and the 1980s, it was known as the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, APUC. And also I want to mention that the utilities have independent boards that also provide governance and oversight of the utilities and what they do. And Golden Valley Electric is a cooperative. Its board members aren't investors. Golden Valley is a nonprofit cooperative. We aren't out to make a profit. We aren't out to pay back investors. We're owned by the members that we serve, and that's how a co-op works. And many of the utilities in Alaska are co-ops. But regardless, the utilities are overseen by the Regulatory Commission, by the boards, and by federal law. And we want to talk about what we do with independent power producers. Mira, I'm sorry. I know you wanted us to get rid of the hearts, but just let you know you don't get everything you want. Utilities have been working with independent power producers in Alaska for a long time. And I've got a list of them up here that we do business with. Now, many of these are from Golden Valley Electric. Aurora Energy, which is on the list, is a independent power producer that produces power from a coal-fired plant in Fairbanks. They are some of our cheapest power at 6.3 cents a kilowatt hour. We wish we could get more from them. We would buy more from them any day of the week. We've recently renegotiated that contract to extend it an additional 5 years. We're very glad to have them as an independent power producer. A lot of the other independent power producers on the list are much smaller. Chena Power is a Bernie Carl company that we buy power from that makes energy from waste products. Delta Wind Farm is a 2-megawatt wind farm project just in Delta. One of the others that's fairly big and we started talking about in terms of being independent power producer is the Bradley Lake project itself. That is a project that's owned by Alaska Energy Authority. I recognize Gene Terrio that's in the audience here today. And Bradley Lake Hydro Project is an independent power producer that the utilities participate in and buy power from. And that's 120 megawatts of power. So I also kind of want to mention the SNAP producers that are on the bottom of the list. This is a program that Golden Valley had developed prior to the net metering mandate, where we provided incentives for our members to put in their own renewable energy, alternative energy projects. You see a solar panel up there. We have a number that are SNAP producers that are people in their homes that produce kilowatt hours, and we buy them from them. Not only do we buy them at our avoided cost, we supplement that by getting contributions from other members that every month on their utility bill pay additional funds so that we can incentivize and try to have more independent SNAP producers providing power for our members. It's been a good partnership there. Another way that we talk about the Golden Valley has worked on helping independent power producers. We developed an experimental renewable tariff to help small independent power producers get online. We filed this tariff and said anyone that wants to produce up to 2 megawatts can get easy access to our system. We're not going to ask you to pay for the backup cost because your system will be small enough. It won't affect us enough. And we're glad to have you. Please come on. And actually, that is how Delta Wind, which is a part of Alaska Environmental Power, came into our system. One other thing I want to talk about is the access that the utilities and the rail belt have developed for our transmission lines. We're very pleased to let everyone know that we adopted open access policies and provisions here as part of the Intertie Management Committee just this past month. Lux Energy Authority voted in favor of that as well. So we have new open access rules for the transmission line that is from Douglas to Healy. Also, the utilities that are part of the Intertie Management Committee committed that their transmission lines would also have open access under the same terms and conditions that the Alaska Intertie has. So now independent power producers can use our transmission line. And, you know, this is something that Brad Evans taught me. He says, you know, open access doesn't mean free access. We think and we provide that users of the lines must pay reasonable costs and they must meet reasonable reliability standards, which were also developed here recently.
Geez, thanks, Corey.
Yeah. Well, it's something that's real, that when someone needs to use a facility, and as we saw telephone utilities go through deregulation and the fact that another telephone carrier could come in and use another carrier's lines, that you've got to pay for that. And the Regulatory Commission oversees that process, and they make sure it's fair and reasonable. No one objects to it under those terms and conditions. So we have cost considerations here about power producers. And, you know, this is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And it's what we talk about as avoided cost. When PURPA was developed in the APUC, pursuant to the federal law, developed standards in Alaska, they developed a standard for avoided cost that says it's going to be the average avoided cost of a utility's power. And I've got a slide coming up in a little bit that's going to kind of demonstrate the complexity of our power systems, at least for the rail belt. And that's something that we've had going on for quite a long time. We think it's worked well. We have a number of independent power producers out there. They're not PURPA providers necessarily, but we have a system of average avoided cost, and it seems to work. It seems to have been working. We hear the independent power producers saying we need to have incremental costs. And we know at this point in time that the Regulatory Commission has opened a docket on this issue. They've taken comments already. I anticipate they'll have hearings, and they'll do a lot of deliberation on what is the appropriate cost that we should have under the PURPA regulations, whether it's average or incremental. But what we would propose and what we tell the Regulatory Commission is that the average avoided cost is easy to calculate and report to the RCA. Golden Valley reports on a quarterly basis to the Regulatory Commission our average avoided cost. So our customers that are providing us power under our tariffs for small users know exactly each quarter how much they're going to get for the kilowatt hours they sell to us. We think it's fair to the ratepayers, it's predictable, and it's, we think, fair to the independent power producers. And we understand there's a difference of opinion here. So under slide on here, we think the incremental cost model, if we go to that, presents problems. Now, we're willing to talk, and we're going to have a discussion about this, and it's going to occur in front of the Regulatory Commission. You know, I want to kind of remind everyone here that the Regulatory Commission is up for sunset this year. I assume that your legislators will be working on that. And, you know, they do good work. They spend a lot of time with non-electric utility issues. They've got a lot of areas that they regulate. To the extent they deal with electric utilities, they take us to task, they hold us to high standards, and then they come to what we think are fair conclusions. We don't always agree with them, but you know that's the process, and we think it works well. So what we talk about the fact that some of the incremental cost model have some issues and problems, and the Regulatory Commission will take a look at this, we think, over the next 6 months to a year, taking testimony and getting expert advice on what we should do with this avoided cost. But I've got here on the slide that some of the incremental cost models ignore some of the issues and problems that we think we would have, one of them being the complexity of developing an incremental cost model. You'll see if I go to the next slide. I picked up the generation here from Golden Valley on January 3, that was last Friday at 9:44 a.m. And what these bar graphs show you is that on that time and at that time on that day, we were getting 72 megawatts of power over the intertie. Thank you, Chugach Electric. And also the hydro from Bradley. And I guess we weren't getting any hydro that day. But Healy 1 was burning about 25 megawatts, providing 25 megawatts of power. Aurora Coal, our independent power producer, was giving us about 27 megawatts of power. Our North Pole plant running on naphtha was giving us about 33. The blue there is kind of a holder that we need to have in place because we have Eva Creek Wind. And you can see Eva Creek Wind at the time was giving us about 13 megawatts of power. And we have a back-end steam generator on North Pole that runs off the exhaust. That's called, that makes that North Pole plant a combined cycle plant, providing us about 10 megawatts. And what we know is that of all the power that we've got there, it's the North Pole Naphtha plant that has to regulate the Eva Creek Wind. Because as the Eva Creek Wind goes down, we have to have enough generation to speed up our system so we can make up any of the lost energy that comes from the wind dying and Eva Creek dropping. The more wind we have, the more North Pole plants we have to have running in order to alleviate what happens when the wind dies down. So one thing that I'm a fairly new CEO at Golden Valley Electric, and I'm still learning a lot, but we have a demonstration here of what Eva Creek looks like. And this is a day in the life of a wind farm. And you can see, maybe it's hard to see, but at the beginning we were getting 25 megawatts of wind power, and that is a very good thing. But very quickly, it dies down to 0 megawatts. And when that wind dies down, we have to throttle up the turbines so that our members don't lose 25 megawatts of power and go dark. So, we have to have a turbine, and in Fairbanks, it's got to be with oil. We have to have a turbine spinning. We can't back up or regulate the wind with our coal plants because it doesn't react fast enough. You know, that's the heating up or cooling down of the boiler. So we have to use a turbine. And then when the wind goes back up to 25 megawatts there, you can see it spike right back up fairly quickly. We have to throttle back the turbine. And we all know when we operate our cars that if we can put the cruise control on at 55 miles an hour and have a steady speed, we get the best fuel economy doing that. When we're accelerating and deaccelerating and back and forth, we are not as efficient. And the same thing happens with turbines. So, you know, we might think that we don't like wind because we have to regulate it like that. But the truth is, again, I've got Mira's heart there. We love renewable energy. We do at Golden Valley. Our board has adopted a renewable energy pledge. We think it's extremely important. Throughout the state of Alaska, 20% of our power comes from renewable sources, and we are always on a quest for additional renewable energy. But what we have to always keep in mind is the question of our kind of our cycle here of our the three what we call it's very hard to read this three considerations that we do when we're going to the regulatory commission and saying here's what we want to do. It's got to be affordable, it's got to be reliable, and it's got to be environmentally minimize the impact. We're worried about the environmental impact. So you can see there we've got the affordable and reliability is fairly bigger balls, and the environmental impact is a little bit smaller. And that is kind of where we are with the regulatory commission and where we look at it and say, here's what we need to do. And as Golden Valley is bringing on the new Healy 2 coal plant, and working with not only the Regulatory Commission, but the EPA and the DEC about the environmental impacts of a coal plant, we said we understand that we need to operate a good, clean coal plant, and we will agree to put on the SCR, the most expensive environmental controls available today for the NOx, and it added $80 million to our project cost. That's an environmental impact, and we've agreed to do that. But we are concerned, and as we go forward, we want to look at the environmental impact, and that cost can't get too large so that it overshadows the affordability and reliability. I have customers that come to my office and say, your utility rates are too high, and I kind of nod and say, yes, we're doing everything we can. And the gold mine say to me, if you don't do something about it, our company is going to deploy their capital to someplace else where it's cheaper to mine gold. We can't operate under this high utility cost. It's way too high throughout all the companies, the countries where we mine gold in areas, your rates are the highest. And I'm sure the senators and everyone else hears that. Same thing from the oil companies about producing up on the North Slope as well. But we're very cognizant of that under our model. And it's something that the Regulatory Commission looks at with us and oversees our rates and what we're doing, and that our board members do as well. So we talk about what's happening in Germany, that when you go to an environmental impact and it's so great, Germany decided to go to 100% renewable by 2050. It was part of the fallout from the nuclear disaster in Japan. They're shutting down their coal and nuclear plants. They're putting in wind, but what they're finding out is that the utility rates are skyrocketing, and the residential folks are complaining that they can't afford their bills. And looking at the rates here, I thought you might find this interesting. It was really not readable that far away. Maybe that screen's better. Those are on the panel. But you'll notice that the USA has an average cost of 12 cents per kilowatt hour. Germany is at 32 cents. Now, Golden Valley at 19.4 cents looks pretty good next to Germany, but it's not as good as Chugach Electric, which is somewhere in the 13-cent range, close to the United States national average. I talked to you about the gold mines that are coming to us and saying businesses can't afford high costs of utilities, and that's what they're hearing in Germany as well. So we've got these high costs in Germany from the excessive renewables. Success is maybe not the right term, from all the renewables that they've put in. And despite that, they haven't seen a reduction in their carbon emissions. And actually, they believe that their carbon emissions have risen, according to a New York Times article late in 2013. And those emissions have risen because the more renewable energy that they have, the more oil-fired generation or other types of generation they have to back it up. So when the wind dies down in Germany, they can ramp up those turbines. So we've got a result where there's higher bills and higher emissions. A couple of extreme situations there. We at Golden Valley, and I think the utilities here recognize that we need to find the middle ground. Maybe bills are a little bit higher, and we want to really drop our emissions. But we've got to do it with due consideration and due thought. And so we talk about questions and decisions for regulators and lawmakers this session as you go back to Juneau. And so we asked the question, what new laws and regulations are necessary? We think there's a pretty good regulatory framework and legislative framework for the utilities. The Regulatory Commission can change the definition of avoided costs to whether it's average or whether it's incremental. They can meet the needs of both the independent power producers and the utilities. We will come together under this docket that's currently opened, and we think there's going to be a lot of good discussion. And again, the Regulatory Commission, they strive to become educated in these issues. They're striving to become more and more knowledgeable on the transmission issues, and they know what the utilities, electric utilities, are facing, and they're working to make sure that they're ready to meet those needs. The utilities, as the comments that we've made in front of the Regulatory Commission, kind of believe that the current regulations work well. We think they fairly compensate the IPPs, but we recognize that there's a difference of opinion here. And we think that RCA will sort this out and hopefully come to a good decision. So I'm going to kind of hold off here at this point and turn it over to Mira, who can kind of give a really good broad view of what the utilities look like in the state of Alaska. Thank you.
If you want to just give me the mouse button.
Thank you. Great presentation, Corey. And thank you for having me here today. I'm going to give you Mira's view of the Alaska utility model.
So keep in mind that this is my perspective, but the data and details come from across the state, usually from state publications. So it's pretty robust. So the first question that we need to look at is how many electric utilities are there? There's a lot of us. There are 222 electric utilities in the state. And this comes, most of these tables come from the Alaska Electric Statistics that was put together by ICER and is published and available on the AEA website. It is the 2011 data, but the 2012 data is not much different. Where I've had more current data, I have updated that in some of the slides. The columns that you see there, the first column, which is what they call it, is titled active. Those are rural electric utilities that are actively participating in the PCE program. The next column is utilities that are arguably eligible for PCE but are not currently active for one reason or another, mostly because they haven't been able to keep up with the paperwork requirements and they've just fallen off the radar. And then the utilities in the 27 column are those utilities that are not eligible for PCE. So what you have there are the rail belt utilities, the Fort Amical utilities, and so forth. So there's 27 of those, totaling 222. Going to the next slide, we see, I'm just giving you a little quick overview of AVEC, Alaska Village Electric Co-op, like Golden Valley, is a nonprofit member-owned electric utility. We've been around since 1968, and we serve 55 villages, about 8,000 meters out there. And we have our employees are primarily Anchorage-based. Those are our administrative, engineering folks, as well as our village technicians who come out of Anchorage and are traveling most of the time. We have 48 power plants and tank farms, and the reason there's 48 and not 55 is because we've been trying to connect our villages. We actually have 7 villages connected to other villages, so we have reduced the number of power plants that we have. The largest fleet of generators in the state and the largest fleet of wind turbines in the state. It's 34, big number. They are small turbines, however, the total capacity is only about 3.6 megawatts, so small but important to us. Last year, in the full year of 2012, 6% of our generation came from wind. And that's pretty impressive considering that they are only actually located in 11 communities. So we get pretty high capacity factors out of those wind turbines. This is something I always like to share just because it puts into perspective the distances of Alaska. You are all familiar with what Alaska looks like relative to the lower 48. But for folks in the lower 48, it's pretty telling how much area Alaska covers. And the other thing that does is it shows you that our northernmost village of Kivalina is more than 800 miles from our southernmost village of Old Harbor. And there's more than 600 miles between Minto and Gamble, which are our east and west communities. So we have a very vast area that we deal with. What I really enjoy is watching Texans when I tell them if you were to cut Alaska in two, Texas would be the third largest state. That's something that we all need to know and rub noses in whenever we have an opportunity. So from our perspective, what does it cost in one of our villages? I first want to point out that the average kilowatt hour sales in one of our villages is about 1.3 million kilowatt hours. That's half as much as the Safeway car store uses that's around the corner. That's my grocery store. So two of our villages can be stuffed into one of those cars villages. I would imagine you could probably put 10 of our villages into a Captain Cook. And so, of course, costs are very high. As you can see, just maintaining the power plant is very high. So the total cost on average is about a third of $1 million to keep a utility operating in a village. That does not include fuel. So our total for 55 villages is just under $20 million. Just a quick comparison of us to Chugach, just because I like to pick on them, because they are, of course, the biggest utility in the state. They have 5 power plants. We have 48. And then all on down the line, you can get a quick picture of why it is so much more expensive to serve a rural Alaska village. And something that's not very familiar to many people is the fifth bullet down. We actually have total plant investment of about $16,000 per meter. And that's actually more than Chugach's, only because their cost to install distribution and so forth is a lot less expensive than ours. But our costs are not any different than it is than they are in urban Alaska. And, of course, the big difference is fuel. Our cost of fuel is more than 30 cents a kilowatt hour, and in urban Alaska here in Anchorage, it's about 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Slightly small numbers, but it's all I could do with those tables. Our net generation in this state in 2011 was almost identical to what it was in 2010, and I would say that it's probably very much the same in 2012 as soon as those numbers are published. About 6.5 billion kilowatt hours is what we sell in this state. And from this chart, you see actually what is next generation in this state with the rail belt, which is, of course, Fairbanks through Anchorage and the Valley and down to Seward and Homer, accounting for 77% of that 6.5 billion kilowatt hours. And you can see what tiny fractions are spread out across the rest of the state. Southeast is a little on the high side because, of course, you've got Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, Wrangell, Petersburg, et cetera. So those are the ones that actually are fairly substantive in Southeast Alaska. So who serves Alaska residents? 71% of the electricity that's produced in the state is produced by a cooperative. So we're talking about the examples there are Chugach, Golden Valley, Matanuska, ourselves, AVEC, many of the other utilities in this room. So that's a pretty sizable chunk. Another 18% are served by municipal or municipal-like utilities. And so those, of course, the biggest of those is Anchorage MLMP. And then most of the utilities in Southeast, other than AELMP, are municipal utilities. And then the final 11% is investor-owned utilities. So there we're talking about Alaska Electric Light and Power, who's the big dog there, Alaska Power and Telephone, and I saw Bob Grimm over here, Bethel, which will soon no longer be an IOU, but nonetheless, those are the larger of the investor-owned utilities that serve the state of Alaska. And where does our money come from? Our capital, surprisingly, is mostly borrowed. There is a relatively low ratio of grant-funded plant in rural Alaska, or at least in our utilities, even though the perception is that that's a very large component. But that's spread across the very small village utilities, and so it's a little out of proportion. In the beginning, in the early years, in the 60s, 50s and 60s and 40s, the bulk of the funding was from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The RUS, Rural Utilities Service, which was formerly the Rural Electrification Administration, was the primary lender. And they had some pretty favorable rates compared with what the market was. In the early 70s, the cooperatives set up their own bank, so NRU CFC, long name, usually called CFC or Cooperative Finance Corporation, is a bank that we cooperatives own. And they actually are capitalized, I think, to the tune of about $60 billion. So they're a very significant player with a very significant bond market and are a major funder of many of us cooperatives. As is CoBank, I think many of the larger utilities here have CoBank as their primary lender, which is also, like us, a nonprofit, although the bulk of its lending is to farm cooperatives. And then there are federal bonds that are guaranteed by the United States. That's one of the funding mechanisms that the RUS uses to fund utilities across the country. Many of the utilities are very competent and have desirable private bonds. Chugach, for example, and Golden Valley, too, I believe, have a very substantial amount of private bonds that are actually very attractive on the commercial market. And then a big chunk is member-owner equity. I think all of us aim towards a 40% equity level. Many of us have achieved that, but typically 25 to 35% is more along the lines of what the utilities can afford in terms of member equity that's brought to the table. So what we have really are utilities that are owned and operated by Alaskans. These assets belong to Alaskans. And so they are unique in that perspective. And that ownership is shared between all of the members. So my members, for example, actually receive an allocation. If we have profits any one year, those are called margins. And those are allocated back to the members in direct proportion to their patronage. In other words, how much electricity they buy, what they pay for that. That's the ratio by which their patronage capital is figured. And then periodically when our finances allow it, those credits are returned back to the membership. So we've actually returned, I think, about $16 million in capital credits in the last 15 years or so back to the membership. And I know I periodically get a little check, actually, from back from Cordova Electric when I was in Cordova. I've even gotten a check from Chugach at one point in time. So we are all in that mode. Every year we look at returning capital back to our members. So a look at our installed capacity since 1962, I think this is a really telling chart. What it shows you is that we enjoyed a fairly steep rise in the development of generation capacity in the state because there was so little of it back in the early 60s. And as the need grew, so did the installed capacity. Those colors are important. The largest purple bar is combustion gas turbine. That's basically what serves the rail belt. And you'll see that since the early 2000s, there's a growing chunk of the light blue, which is the combined cycle generation, where you're actually using the waste heat from the turbines to generate additional electricity. So you have much more efficient generation from those assets. And in fact, the plant that's being installed by Mathenesco Electric, and I'm sure Joe will talk about it some, and also the one that was jointly built by Chugach Electric and Municipal Light and Power, has eclipsed the efficiency of today's combined cycle plant. And I think they're getting about 42% efficiency out of that gas, which really is quite remarkable. The other big bar on the bottom is the lighter blue. That's hydro. You'll see that hydro is pretty static right now. We do see a little jump there in 2010. I think that was some work that was done at Bradley Lake primarily, and then a couple of smaller hydros that were brought on in Southeast Alaska. And in between is us, internal combustion. So all the diesel generation is the green bar. And if you look really hard between the green and the blue in the bottom, you'll see a little tiny streak of red, and that's wind generation in the state. And of course, this chart is only as of 2010, and I'm expecting to see that starting to grow pretty rapidly in coming years as Fire Island has come on board and Golden Valley's system and AEP's system. I don't think ours makes much of a blip, but nonetheless, it's there. It's a part of it. But looking at it by region, this goes to show again where that generation is. And you'll see, of course, the big chunk there is South Central. Again, this is natural gas. And you've got some hydro there, of course. You've got Kalutna, Bradley Lake, and I think Cooper Lake is in there as well. And then you have all the rest of the state makes up the other one-third with the graphs are available. I assume that these will be posted on the legislative website as well as on APA's website. So people are welcome to use, abuse, reuse, do whatever you want with what we have up here. So in 2011, where our electricity came from, the big yellow blob is, of course, gas. The blue 6% is coal. That's all in the Fairbanks area. 20% across the state came from hydro, the bulk of that actually from southeast, and 16% from oil. And wind was a mere 0.3%. But again, as I said, I think that number is going to show some significant changes over time. And then this is another depiction of generation by fuel source for the last 40 years. And I just thought it was an interesting little feature to include in there. This is a horrible depiction. At least this map here isn't so good. The one on my left is a lot better. And that's sales by Alaska Energy Authority energy regions. And you can see the percentage by region and by the types of purchasers. So you got residential in the first column, commercial in the next, and then other. And other typically is industrial, where you have military and or mines. So Golden Valley, for example, would not Golden Valley, but Fort Knox would fit in there. And who buys that electricity? These bars show you that 80%, 85% of all of the customers in Alaska are residential. That's the 275,000. But if you look at the sales by residential customers, it's only about a little less than 35% of the total sales. So the little tiny bit of 2% of the customers, which is the other, accounts for more than 22% of sales in the state. So those are the very desirable customers because they bring economies of scale
to all the other users in the state. And those are the customers that arguably we don't serve as well as we should. And here again, it tells you where the customers are by numbers of customers, residential, commercial, and other. And look at what our typical capital investment is. I just highlighted five utilities, stuck myself on the bottom. I start off with Chicago Electric, which has about $1.1 billion of utility plant, 82,000 customers. So their investment per meter is just over $14,000. And that number is actually replicated and grown upon by other utilities. You see that Kodiak Electric is the largest investment per customer. They have a $156 million utility plant and only 5,800 customers. So they're approaching $27,000 per customer. Hydro is expensive. They have 9 megawatts of wind generation. That's expensive. What a lot of people don't realize is that they also have 27 megawatts of diesel generation, their backup generation. So they have a great deal more capacity than you would otherwise think, and most of it is standby. So that's why their investment per customer is high. I just wanted to touch on the necessity for utilities to have redundancy. I would start with my own example at the bottom where you see Alaska Village. We have 52 megawatts of installed diesel capacity and about 4 megawatts of wind capacity. Our peak load is 17 megawatts, and our average load is about 9 megawatts. And you say, wow, that's terrible utilization of the capacity. But here's the issue. We typically have 3 generators in a village, and any one of them can carry the village at a particular time of the year. But we have to plan for the fact that we have a generator that's running on its own, picking up all of the load, and we have another one down for maintenance, typically an overhaul, and then the third one breaks. And you wind up in a situation where you really are in a very tight situation. I have 2 villages like that right now. You don't ever hear from us because we take care of our own problems. In Selawik, for example, we threw a rod on our largest generator, and we are going to have to fly a generator in because we can't afford to be on that low of redundancy capacity. You cannot have a protracted outage when it's 20 below or 40 below outside. That simply is not an option. Going up the chart, look at Kodiak Electric. They have 21 megawatts of hydro, 9 megawatts now of wind. Their average load, or their peak load just actually this month, was 28 megawatts. So they were burning diesel to make up that additional those additional megawatts. The wind and the hydro blend together, and they optimize each other. But because of the way that they have operated, last year they generated 4.5% of their electricity with diesel fuel, and they expect that to be close to zero with their third hydro turbine having come online just very recently. And I also wanted to show you Chugach Electric. I've heard rocks thrown at them about the old capacity that they have installed. That capacity of 530 megawatts does not include Bradley Lake or Fire Island because they don't own those assets. But their peak load just a few days ago was 490 megawatts. That's skating on pretty thin ice. That's when utility managers like Brad and I stay up at night worrying about what happens if you lose a 60-megawatt turbine. So finally, we as electric utilities are obliged to serve our customers. We have a certificate of public convenience necessity that says that we will serve our customers under all circumstances. And obviously, reliability and affordability are our key governing factors. We have to have generation redundancy because that is what demonstrates reliability for our customers. We have all embraced renewables somewhat cautiously. Others of us have sort of thrown our caution to the wind and gone all full bore. We're expecting to get 35-plus percent of our generation from wind on some of our Class 6 villages off of St. Lawrence Island. And we all seek to excel. I think that Alaska, for being a small state, has got some extremely competent electric utilities, and I'm proud to call them all compadres, friends, and colleagues. And that's it. That's one of my linemen going, I know there's a meter down there somewhere. We sent that down to the lower 48, by the way. Let them enjoy it, too.
Good presentation by both the presenters. I will try to give you an overview of the generation and transmission system on the rail belt and some of the wrinkles that we're dealing with currently. It's been a rather dry topic so far, so I thought I'd give you a couple of vignettes of what has made my life exciting in the last few days. First, I don't know why I didn't sit down there, but Crystal told me I had to come up here, so here I am. And I've always done what Crystal said, including 15 years ago at the Chamber of Commerce when she was my speechwriter. Secondly, I just spent 3 hours in here last night getting the hell beat out of me by the Planning and Zoning Commission, and they turned down one of my substations as crucial to serving some 2,000-plus customers, and I don't know what I'm going to do about that. Other than that, it's been a great day. How do we move this thing forward? Try one of these. The forward
button.
Here's what the rail belt is made up, as somebody has already said, I believe Mary did. All co-ops are government-owned. MLMP and Seward are government-owned. Chugach, Golden Valley, Homer, and Matanuska are all co-ops. I'm not going to spend a lot of time telling you what co-ops are because you all know that. I guess it was Marilyn that said that she was proud to be with formerly ARICA, now APA, and it's 62-year-old. And I'll remind you that Matanuska is 72, so O to be 62. There you are. The transmission system in the rail belt hooks us all together. It facilitates economic dispatch that's worth a tremendous amount of money. It transfers power to where it's needed, and it lets us share reserves. All of those make money for the membership. We are hooked to no one else. There is no FERC involved in anything we do. Because we're not, it doesn't fall under the constitutional commerce clause, so FERC doesn't have an oar in the water. I really think they would like to, but so far we've resisted that. The generation system looks like this, and I've numbered all of these, and I'm not going to go through each one of them in detail. I put them on here like this so you, when you get pieces of this briefing, you can look at it and see where everything is. The big ones on here are Bradley Lake, Wautana, eventually up here about 125 miles upriver from the mouth down here. The Chugach plant, Beluga, is the biggest one in the rail belt. Fire Island is the wind in the south, and up here in the north, you've got Eva Creek up in that vicinity. There are Healy 1 and 2 is at Healy. And you've got a geothermal project that's being considered at Mount Spur. That has not been an easy task to find the additional source of heat, and that's strange because they're looking in a situation that you can look up the side of the mountain and see an active volcano. But to date, they don't have a sufficient heat supply to, and they are some 25 miles or so to the west of Beluga that would require a transmission link to deliver the power. The generation suite looks like this, and if that is just simply a breakdown of who owns what in the rail belt, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. It ranges from Homer's, Nikiski, Soldat, and Bernice Lake plants up to those in Golden Valley, North Pole, Eva Creek, Keeley 1 and 2, etc. and that's simply there for your own use if you want to know where the plants are. And if you're interested in what their ratings are, I can give you that too, but I didn't intend to do that in this presentation. The rail belt situation is that the new generation changes have really changed the playing field. The transmission system was not originally built to accommodate the location of the generation that we now have on the system. To a degree, it limits the Bradley-Lake Power deliveries when they are needed most. The IMC, Intertie Management Committee, and the Bradley Project Management Committee are dealing with those issues as we speak. Our economy demands reasonably priced power, and of course so does the rest of Alaska. And when you find high-priced power, you find that the economies don't do as well. And of course the RCA insists that cost causers are the cost payers, and I think that's a good concept that we should all adhere to. AEA did a transmission study this last summer, summer of 2012. They proposed several upgrades to the transmission system. Quartz Creek, the university, is an AC line. They wanted to add an additional conductor from Quartz Creek to Dave's Creek. That's right north of Kenai Lake. And upgrade eventually the system to a 230 kV from Dave's Creek University substation, and that's the Chugach line. They also proposed the DC tie from Bernice Lake to Beluga. That was about almost a $200 million project. They proposed a second 115 kV line from Bradley Junction to Soldotna. That was long overdue, should have been built with the original Bradley project, and was not. We ran out of money on transmission early in that effort. And they proposed a 25-megawatt battery in Anchorage to back up the system when you did have an outage. Northern upgrades were to build a Lake Loraine transmission substation, a new link from Lake Loraine to go around the MEA section that's a bit weak going from Teeland up to Douglas. Douglas is at Willow. A new link there, and then 230 kV from Douglas to Healy, because that is a strong line, and that's the AEA so-called Alaska intertie, and that's the state-owned piece of the intertie system in the rail belt. The rest of it's all private-owned. Here's a slide of what's going on. This is the existing system. And these maps are in here for your use as needed. Here are the upgrades proposed. And I'm not going to go through them again, but I just read them to you. But it shows you here on the map where they are. Here's the big kahuna. That would be the old Southern intertie back in the early 90s that we were talking about. We never built the one that was we talked about. But this would provide a second link from Soldotna to the load center, principally at Anchorage. The only loops in the system are right up here, and there are two lines from Healy North. So there is a bit of a redundancy up there. The rest of it is, in many cases, single line. It's essentially a single line from Soldotna to Anchorage, and for all practical purposes, a single line from Bradley Lake to Soldotna. There are actually two that run out of Bradley over to what's called Bradley Junction. And I'm not going to go through all the detail here. I blew them up so you can see what the ads are. And what's proposed. Here's what architect's looking at, and I borrowed these slides essentially from one that Chugach had put together. Brian Hickey has been working on this for a year now, and our view is that a Transco makes a lot of sense in the rail belt, and a Transco owns transmission systems, owns or operates them. I don't think that we would all have to own them. They are a regulated entity, owns, constructs, maintains, and transmits wholesale power. They could handle power dispatch and coordination, and life would be a lot easier in the rail belt if we had a single operator. In fact, we spend an inordinate amount of time coordinating among the various load balancing areas, and that would be resolved with a single operator. They can secure financing, and they do projects. To operate a Transco, you need somebody that's the adult supervision in the area, and that would be the ISO. ISO generally owns no assets. They're supposedly a neutral party that has no oar in the water. They don't care who is making money or who isn't. They're just interested in economic delivery of power. So they're responsible for planning, management, control of the system in a particular region. The region we're talking about, of course, would be the rail belt. They ensure non-discriminatory access. Corey already mentioned that we have ascribed to an open access philosophy, at least on the state intertie, and to some degree, the rest of us have said, yeah, we think we can do that. Possesses operational authority for all the facilities under their control. It has exclusive authority to maintain short-term reliability. They operate under regulation, and they plan, condition, and approve projects. The what's the could-be rail belt model? It could, our Transco could be the ARCTEC organization providing non-discriminatory access, take existing assets from the transmission providers, pool them under joint use agreements, very similar to what happens on the North Slope with oil company assets. Come up with a universal rate based on the system loads as well as the power you use that will ensure economic transfer of the power across the network. And you could probably do this by starting with a single control area, do an economic dispatch, and ensure centralized planning. And that's the objective of this whole thing, is to ensure that it's economically dispatched, hopefully by a single entity, and centralized planning would ensure no duplication of assets. So without a program to rectify these transmission issues, and that's one of the requests that's in, once again, into the legislature for $37.5 million to get this project started, it's probably an 8 to 10 year effort to bring the rail belt up to what it should have been back in the mid-80s when we ran out of money out of the Sioux Sigma project. We're going to see increasing cost of electricity. You will potentially lose upwards of $100 million a year, and that's not chump change, because of the lack of full economic dispatch. By the way, Chugach does achieve that fairly well today. They spend a lot of time economically dispatching. And there is no way we will ever achieve our goal of 50% alternative and renewable power by 2025 if we don't fix this transmission system. And we're going to all be captive to the Cook Inlet gas market, and you've seen the volatility and the difficulties in that. Right now, we're in pretty good shape through March of 2018. Beyond that is a question mark again, and that puts us today inside the window to figure out the answer to the problem of how we get future gas. We should be planning for that today, and that takes capital money to get out there. Next steps, we want to continue the 50-50 relationship, the so-called Bradley Lake model, between the state and the utilities for transmission. Reliability standards and open access proceeding through the RCA process, and those documents, if they haven't been filed yet, will be soon. And ARCTEC is proceeding with looking at the Transco ISO options. And I'm happy to answer any questions and further discussion as may be necessary, Senator.
Thank you, Marilyn. And I are sharing a microphone here because mine is directed down to our colleagues on the line. And so I want to be sure they're included in it. I just want to say thank you to all of the presenters, Corey, Mira, Joe, and Marilyn. We appreciate all of your thoughts, and they've been very enlightening. They'll be recorded. We will have them on a website, and I think that's going to be important for the future as this discussion moves forward. The first question I want to pose to Joe, first of all, many lawmakers, including myself, have the $37.5 million allocation on our priority list, and the notion of the Transco model is something that certainly is something I believe we need to move forward as a state. You know, I appreciate your leadership. I want to say thank you. We tried with Gretzky, got, you know, as close as we could, and now we've got the AvTech model. We have made some capital investments along the way, a couple of line items when I was on finance, but most of them were individualized. And so this is really a leadership model, and I want to say thank you to all of you for working forward on that. I think the idea of separating out your transmission and your generation is exactly where we need to go. And to that end, as we look at this issue of independent power producers, how would they factor in? You had a line item there that I thought was great, and it reminds me of FERC, which is that when you have an open access, non-discriminatory system, then it's the RCA that sort of takes those requests for entry. So in light of that, what do you think, you know, the process would be for an IPP to integrating their projects in? What would be the potential obstacles? What would be the potential barriers?
Thank you, Senator, for a very relevant question. That inevitably the issue becomes the economics of what they can provide. And my view has always been with my utility that bring me the right program and I'll buy your power. And it has to be economic. They have to pay for the connectivity. They have to pay the costs to get to the customer that we're going to provide. They can't run their machines at the expense of cheaper machines. That's the one that always gets them. So they have to recognize that they have to have reserves, and they've got to have a fuel supply naturally. So meeting all of those criteria is a bit of a hurdle today in the rail belt, and I suspect anywhere else. But to the degree you can do that, you have a marketable product. I don't think there's a one of us in here that wouldn't buy cheaper power, given the opportunity to do it. But we do not want to burden our membership with higher cost power to make somebody else's program work. And that's the one that you just get beat up on, and the RCA would never permit it on a large scale.
And so just to drill down on this, and then I want to open it up to Senator Bishop, Representative Isaacson, certainly Representative Tarr, if you'd like to come forward and just grab a microphone, you're welcome up here. And then you know, questions open to other lawmakers. So I'll just synthesize it without going through five or six steps. I think the gist of it for lawmakers that have been interested in the IPP question, we support our local utilities. I've been very clear about that. We support the idea that you have to have fair rates, that these are co-ops that are fundamentally invested in by the people. And at one long point ago, we used to return dividends. I look at Brad. It's been a long time, but at some point we did have dividends from Chuga.
And we will again.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And I know a lot of Alaskan families are. But as we look into the future, there is that tension that comes between wanting to create competition and innovation, and knowing that often those ideas, those new sources of power, can move consumers ahead in terms of their ultimate lowering of costs. You look at a Bradley Lake, which is by far the lowest cost on the power supply. So when you do an average of that, it seems like the independent power producers are always at a disadvantage because you're averaging all of that up. So how do you defend, just so that we know as lawmakers, the notion that the average should be used as opposed to the incremental? Their position is we have an opportunity coming in. Let's say they're a wind provider in the Delta. And they're saying, look, we can provide this power at a lower rate than the highest cost that's going into, let's say, Golden Valley. And as a result, in time, that's going to increase the pool, increase the competitive rate, and ultimately benefit consumers. It may not immediately, but it will over time. How do you defend that? Help us kind of understand the difference between, and many of you touched on it, average versus incremental cost.
Well, I think, Senator, that Corey touched on the average versus incremental cost issue. With somebody that has a power plant like ours will be, it's pretty straightforward. But somebody who has a mixture like Fairbanks, it's a whole different can of snakes, because they don't, you don't know which of their units happens to be running at any given time. In my case, they're all about the same. To a degree, Chugach has the same situation, that they have different costs of power delivered. What that does is requires some standard that you can measure the economics of wind or whatever the alternative supply is. The answer really is, if you have something you can do with the heat, then the project begins to look remarkably good. And that was the whole intent of PURPA to start with. There's combined heat and power plants. And they anticipated years ago that the heat would be of value and electricity would be generated by virtue of, it was almost a freebie. To the degree you can do that, that makes the project viable. If they're going to compete directly with a co-op, they're going to have trouble getting in there, because they've got to pay the full carrying cost to get there to be economic. And we will all run the same numbers to compare them. And they burn the same cost fuel that we do, so they don't end up with any big advantage there. In the wind power case, they've got to have reserves. And you saw Corey's chart up there that showed the swings. Now, that's easy to provide in the kind of engines that are installed or soon to be installed and running at EGS, but you don't want to have to follow wind with gas turbines unless you absolutely have no other choice, because their efficiencies go to pot really quick.
So
it's a challenge, but can it be done? Yeah, I think it can, but you got to really have a sharp pencil to get there.
Well, I thank you for that, Joe, and I'd like to turn to Brad. And to
Tim,
our new director, my apologies, I'm still thinking Jim in my mind, to comment on the issue. Both of you have this issue, Chugach in particular, but fixed power, how that works with more transient power, and how we should be thinking about that as lawmakers, how that factors into your overall cost and how you have to plan, especially for peak loads.
I'll take the first crack at that, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. It should be no surprise to anybody in the room that utilities, even within the rail belt, have different constraints and different problems and challenges in addressing that issue. But certainly what we find here in the rail belt is completely different than what you might find somewhere else in the state of Alaska. So you're not going to get an answer that covers the ashtray for everybody. That's just not possible. We don't regulate in a liquids-based system with oil-fired generation, so we don't have the capacity. Our fuel capacity is the next hour schedule. So if you want to change that fuel schedule, you have to go all the way back to the producers and through the pipelines. By the time you get it done, the wind's already changed. So that's completely different than what Corey described for Golden Valley, where they have oil in storage, and it's not as difficult to throttle back. Doesn't mean it's easy. It just means that for some of us, it's more difficult than others. And we principally use hydroelectric to regulate that. And our biggest challenge in hydroelectric is constrained transmission. And it's set to get here worse, because there's so much generation built on the Kenai that the transmission line to the Kenai now is even further constrained as far as getting Bradley Lake out. We have issues down there we're trying to wrestle through on using that resource. Regulation. So we principally use that, but for us, it becomes quite difficult in terms of you don't always run hydro. Hydro is not base loaded. I mean, if you recall our numbers, we're about, 50% of our average load is about 50% of our peak, and that's kind of where we planned up base load generation. So it actually marries up pretty good, but we use hydro principally, or have used in the past, hydro principally for peaking and intermediate loading, not base loading. So if I'm going to use it to regulate, the wind comes at me 24/7, 365. I mean, some days are dead, but I mean, in anticipation of that, I can't say whether it's going to be at peak or base loaded or whatever. So we have to actually change how we use hydro to do that, and there's an economic consequence of that. So it's not quite that simple. We do have a project that we're taking a look at that's using flywheel and battery technology, where it's a demonstration project. There's an information board in the back that describes that project, and that may or may not work for other people, but we're hopeful that it helps us regulate wind, because we don't want to spill the wind. We spill the wind when we just can't keep up with the variability of it, and it's not our goal to spill any wind, because I have to pay for the wind and the makeup generation, so it's like paying twice for that. So our goal is not to curtail or not to spill, or whatever your word of choice is on that. But I can't say that what Chugach is looking at, it's not even the same as Golden Valley. And so certainly somebody who has, like Kodiak, where they have a lot of hydro generation relative to their overall load, they're able to actually achieve a higher level of performance there in regulation. We'd like to have more hydro, because in my mind, an easier way to regulate wind. We're working on that. We're expanding a couple hydro projects with diverting creeks into it. So we have a pretty active program to grow our renewable portfolio, which kind of addressed the environmentally sound part of that. And it's certainly what I have to say about it isn't necessarily everything there is to know, regarding regulation on that. We're going to learn a lot with our demonstration project. We're picking a size for the project to where it could be scalable so that we could put more of it in as the need arises. If there was a flood of gas and we could get all the regulation stuff we needed and start treating the gas supply like a stored oil base for generation, then that would change how we might necessarily do that. But sometimes it's a combination of the intervening pipelines, because they transport the gas, and sometimes it becomes a problem of producers with deliverability on how much they can ramp up and ramp down. So there are some practical limits that we deal with all the time. Maybe they're not practical, but they're embedded in the system. And it's terribly complex, and we're working every day to try to resolve that, and I think we're making some progress on that. But again, I'll remind you that my answer isn't going to fit somebody else's problem. So I'll turn it over to Tim now.
And Tim and Jody as well, I want to be sure you get an opportunity to participate.
And we have Sabrina.
Oh, and Sabrina, my apologies.
Well, thanks, Andrew. Our situation, of course, is very unique as I guess everyone's is, but we are essentially all hydro there in Juneau. And I see Chris Bruton back here. He's in the same kind of situation, Sitka, and I see Bob Graham sitting there, and he's got a lot of hydro in his system, but in Juneau, we're nearly all hydro. And the thing that, about hydro that makes us a little bit different is that there's no fuel cost. It's all the costs are up front. Basically, your debt service, your operations, and your maintenance. And so your costs don't change by the number of kilowatt hours you use. So in other words, our costs for our annual costs are the same if we sell half of our energy or all of our energy from those hydro projects. And those hydro projects vary from year to year. We never have the same number of kilowatt hours available from one year to the next, because it all depends on climate that year, how much precipitation we get. And so we have a variable output. We do use a small amount of diesel. The only time we use diesel is in emergencies, or testing and exercising units. So almost no diesel used. For us to purchase power from another entity, for example, the ski area has, they weren't connected to our system for many, many years. they have a very tiny little hydro project at ski area there. They would like to sell their surplus energy back to us in the summertime, and I'd love to buy it. But for me to buy their energy would mean that I would spill my energy, and there's no cost associated with my energy. So I would have to give away my free energy, let it tumble down a stream, and then buy theirs. And that just wouldn't be fair to my customers to do that sort of thing. So that's kind of the situation we have with the hydro.
That's a great example. Thank you. Jody.
Thanks, Senator McGuire. Thanks for holding this roundtable for us. I don't have much to add to what has already been said, except that in Southeast, where we serve, at where IPEC serves, we have five communities, and three of them are 100% diesel. And the two communities that are on hydro are connected, and we own one project, and we buy power from IPP, actually from Bob Grimm. So I don't know much about reserves, just what I've been hearing from my colleagues, but we will have that situation coming up soon because we are in the process of building a hydro at Huna, which will be won't cover 100% of the load, but so we'll have to supplement it with diesel probably pretty much year-round. So it's going to be an interesting situation to see exactly how much the savings will be when we get there. So, but I guess in this discussion, I think the point I want to make, or something that I have encountered before, is that I had an IPP approach one of my communities at one point, offering 6.8 cent power when nothing was built yet. There were no designs, there were no plans whatsoever. They just pulled that rate out as what was being sold by SEPA. And, of course, got, you know, my community all riled up, and why aren't we doing that? Well, you know, you can't – so far I don't think they found a way to transmit or generate electricity out of thin air. So it was you know, but it really was disturbing that somebody could make claims like that and have nothing to back it up. So I think in this discussion it should be pointed out that a lot of times you just don't have – all of the, they don't tell you or share information with you that you must have in order to make a decision about whether or not that's a good decision for your utility. And of course, we all want to reduce rates. That's a given, I think, in any situation, especially in a diesel community. I mean, you have to do that for your people.
And Jody, we'll turn to Sabrina, but just what I would love, and I ask this on behalf of the lawmakers that'll be, you know, looking at this issue this next session, is a follow-up from all of you after we've had this hearing today along the lines of what you said. You know, these are the following challenges, and here are some potential solutions. So if one of those is that you have IPPs coming into the community making claims which you feel are unsubstantiated and there isn't that appropriate factual-based communication, fact-based communication, how can that be improved on their part and on your part in terms of receiving it? So I just say that generally to everyone that, you know, over the years, this has been one of those kind of percolating issues, but it's sort of raising up to a level, and that's the point of the hearing today. And it really does strike at Alaskans because they are paying high energy costs. Mm-hmm. And so they look to this issue and they say, well, could that be the reason? And they want to know, they want to understand. And so it's not to say our utilities aren't great, people aren't doing a good job. It's that Alaskans, I think, are hungry for affordable energy. So this will be a topic that will be out there this next session. So, Sabrina.
Well, at TDX, we represent yet another end of the spectrum. We're not a co-op. We're an independently owned organization, Alaska Native Corporation, and we have four regulated utilities that sell power directly to customers in the communities that they operate. And we also have now two certificated, I guess, IPPs. In St. Paul, we have three wind turbines in place and have an arrangement to sell our wind to the city of St. Paul, which is another utility operating solely on diesel. And the goal being obviously to reduce the dependence on diesel in that island community, which, you know, as we all know, any community that's operating on diesel that's far-flung, it's expensive. And so the hope there is to insulate customers from the, you know, rising costs of diesel by using that wind. And we've done the same thing in our community of Sandpoint, where we actually own and operate the utility, and we also own and operate the an IPP for wind sales. And we have about we have 1 megawatt of wind in Sandpoint, and our peak load in Sandpoint is right around 750 kW. So these are all small communities. We have about 650 customers in Sandpoint, but the wind project has been in Sandpoint operational for about a year and a half, and we're working on a lot of bugs, but to increase our reliability in Sandpoint for wind, we're also looking at flywheel battery solutions, trying to work with AEA on some grant options to kind of smooth out our use of wind and be able to use more wind. That's one of our issues in Sandpoint is we'd like to use more wind. We've got an awful lot of resource out there, and reduce diesel. You know, Sandpoint, we're pretty lucky because we have a large fish processor, so they have a pretty significant diesel fuel farm. And so our prices, while high, are fairly stable, and because we have pretty easy access to that resource. However, diesel is expensive, and diesel generation is expensive, and small communities, it takes a lot of money if you want to replace and upgrade that diesel equipment to newer, more efficient equipment. It's a significant investment, and we have such a small population, it's really hard to try to balance what the cost to upgrade is versus your savings and efficiency. And so luckily the wind project was funded partially with grant funds from AEA. So that made it really effective, and we felt that was a really good use of our resources to invest in that. Not everybody is so lucky to be able to do that. And we have another community in Manly that is very tiny. I mean, we have about 100 customers, and so we have a couple generators, and they're all diesel. And, you know, we explored geothermal, but when you only have 100 customers, geothermal it's tough. It's an expensive way to go, and so we just haven't been able to make that work. We kind of had to let that go, and will we revisit it in the future? Possibly. If somebody else wants to develop that resource and they think they can do it and be more cost-effective than we can, it's a little tiny grid out there. If they think they can produce power, we'd be happy to buy it if we could save our customers money. I don't think that's an issue at all. And then we have the complete opposite end of the spectrum. In Prudhoe Bay, we have the utility in Dead Horse. And so we have virtually unlimited gas, big commercial. We don't have a single residential customer. And everybody is hungry for more power. And so in that case, when we're now faced with needing to expand our generation, and it's a pretty easy decision because we have customers who are clamoring for more power, and our customer base can pay for it. And the customer base is growing so rapidly that the investment, we're hoping that we don't even have to raise rates because of it, because the large growth in the load demand. I'm not making any promises that we're not going to have to after that plan is put in place. But, you know, that would be the goal, and it just, you know, it's just how the math works out. And then far south, we have a community like ADAC, and I see in our audience some folks from the Aleut Corp who are heavily invested in ADAC. And that's a situation where we have old, decrepit equipment. We have both transmission and distribution. You have an extremely small community, and you have some folks that would really like to develop that, but the cost to develop and put in new distribution, we don't really have transmission because it's, you know, so small, but new distribution and new generation is quite large, and for a very small community. And so how do you spread that cost? They're trying to do hydro in ADAC, which is wonderful. ADAC has, well, and possibly wind, depending on how that study goes. Hydro and wind are great in ADAC. You're, again, an island community, and you have to bring in your diesel, and diesel is expensive. So people, you know, are they're captive to the price of diesel, and they're also captive to older, inefficient equipment that force higher fuel rates for the customers to have to pay for the fuel that generates their power. But again, you have, I think this is where the state, if they're going to help, they need to look at things like that with hydro. For this project, it would have a huge benefit, and it would offset the cost of power for this community for many, many years to come. But it's a huge investment. I think they're talking along the lines of $37 million. And then just the integration of that, you always need diesel. As we're talking in the group, you need backup for that hydro. You need fossil fuel backup. You also need a significant investment in the distribution system. And so part of that project would need to be that significant investment, and those two things go hand in hand. And as the utility in ADAC, we'd be happy to work with an IPP. However, we can't accept any renewable resource power in our system right now, given the condition. And so those are the things that need to be thought of, that, you know, we want folks to look at, and how the state and other funding sources can help either IPPs wanting to develop that resource or help the utility, you know, if there's a way that they can support us to do our part to make that power more acceptable into the system and reduce the cost of power to those types of communities. So we've got the broad range of all sorts of different problems between our utilities, and we're IPPs and we're utilities, and so we have these conversations internally a lot on how to fix ourselves. But that's where we are, and those are the kinds of issues that the state should consider.
Thank you for that, Sabrina. That really helped. I think that does give a viewpoint of how the complexity, and that when you're talking about an IPP, it's not just one definition. There are lots of different ways that they work with utilities and sometimes don't work. Okay, and so I want to turn it to Senator Chris Bishop for questions, if that's okay, with our utility folks, and you jump in as you'd like, unless he directs it. And then I want to go to the representatives that are online, Representative Edgman and Representative Isaacson.
Senator, if you don't mind, if you want to go to the online people first,
okay,
then I'll clean up.
All right, I like it.
I just want to make one quick comment. It's sure nice to put a name with a face where I send my bill every month to Sabrina. So thank you for that manly power.
That's wonderful. So I'll go to the, because we'll end at 4 so that you all can be on time for your next appointment. But I'll go to Representative Edgman and then Representative Isaacson. Are you there?
Isaacson is here.
Okay, Representative Isaacson.
Well, hey, thank you so much, Senator McGuire, and to all who are there, I really wish I could be there with you today in person as I was with the last roundtable. I would love to see the presentations and absorb the facts and graphs that were presented. As many know in the room, I've been looking at, as co-chair of House Energy, what the next step in our policy should be, and how do we continue to make sure we get affordable energy to all parts of Alaska. I just was in a chamber meeting today, and Senator Bishop, they all extend their loss at not seeing you, but understandably you're there. But again, energy was huge. That is the biggest topic and need in Interior Alaska in the Fairbanks North Pole area. But as another preface is, I really enjoyed hearing Joe's discussion about ArcTech, and how you're looking at forming a uniform dispatch, and the discussions that have been entered into. Corey brought it up, and Joe both, and others about how to integrate independent power producers, the IPPs, more beneficially. And so there's going to be some vigorous conversation. I hope we can have some of these in committee this year, and I'm glad RCA is tackling it. But as we look forward to the future, the comments that Mira and Sabrina brought forward really kind of echo a lot of what has been going on during this interim session, and that is, how do we connect our rural communities, and how do we create affordable energy without duplicating in the future the problems that we're facing today? Let me add to that a little bit. Right now we have six utilities for less than 400,000 people. In the lower 48, they would have millions of people on one utility system. So it seems that we've got some redundancies that have built up over the course of our population, you know, that as one speaker had said, this wasn't expected a long time ago. Our transmission lines, therefore, are substandard. But how do we fund the connectivity between our current communities on the rail belt, and then how do we grow that transmission system to all other communities on the rural road system, which would really expand our ability to wheel power, and therefore I would assume lower the cost eventually, because you're getting that much more power. So you could connect Tok and Glen Ellen, lower their cost, encourage development of our natural resources out there because you have low-cost energy, encourage settlement. And then how do we build it to take transmission to off the road system, and how do we avoid, if we're creating more microgrids to help with, say, Ambler Mining District, how do we avoid creating another utility out there that would eventually then compete with growth with the current utilities? So kind of a complex question that, and I'm trying to get my arms around, what should we be doing? Give you an idea, should we, the legislature, create a mandatory public benefit fund that would then help distribute the cost, a penny per kilowatt or something, so everyone has a hand in paying for transmission line upgrades, and then we use that fund to continue expanding transmissions? Or what are your thoughts on this issue I'm trying to get my arms around?
Excellent. Who would like to comment? Corey?
Thanks. This is Corey Borges, and Representative Isaacson, I appreciate your question, and I'll see if I can dance around it a little bit. Then I'll ask Joe or Mayor Brad or someone else to add on. There's a lot of questions there, and a few observations about the transmission lines and how it might relate to independent power producers, at least on the rail belt. And for other areas, we see that independent power producers are out there, and they're interested, and we like that. For the rail belt, some of the issues are the constraints on the rail belt make it very difficult for independent power producers. And for you as legislators to realize that that's a problem is a great start. And we've got to fix the constraints on the rail belt transmission line. You know, it's not only about access for independent power producers, but it's also about the fact that the more constrained these lines are, the more line losses are, and the more losses there are to the utilities. So it's going to solve a number of problems for the legislature working with ARCTEC and the utilities, who are all kind of bound together here, to get this problem fixed on the constraints. It's big, and it's big money, and it'll help. The transmission lines and having access is very important. It's like a highway. You know, you say, oh, hey, you can use our highway, but by the way, you can't get onto the on-ramp because the traffic's too severe. So we need to get a resolution to that, and we've been working on it, and we've been coming to the legislature, and we hope this year we'll have some progress. I maybe have a voice in this here a little bit differently from others in the rail belt, but I think while the state has a significant interest in helping on this, I think the utilities themselves are going to have to kind of step up and do a little something. We have difficult issues. Our balance sheets are not in the best shape, but we've gone through significant growth and development in our generation issues. it somehow has to be, we call it the Bradley model, where we both participate and the state puts some effort into it. You've got, as legislators, there's a real interest in having lower energy costs so that we can have more development and more growth in the state. So as we pitch in together to make that work, I think we will move forward and solve some of those problems. So that's part of your question there, and maybe somebody else can step up and answer some of the other questions that you had.
I'll try another version, but I guess to put a picture in everybody's minds, I mean, in the rail belt, and again, I got to stress that solutions here don't necessarily replicate themselves everywhere. I mean, go back to the geographical diversity of the state, and then ask yourself if you think it's practical to interconnect the whole thing. And I would be a little skeptical to start with, but that doesn't mean there's not opportunities for things. But in the rail belt, it's a little bit like I went and got a load of sand in my pickup and it's got a flat tire. The answer is not to throw more sand in the back of the pickup, it's to fix the flat tire. We've got transmission problems in the rail belt that need attention. It's constraining us from optimizing the utilization of renewable resources right now. So putting more on there isn't going to fix it. You need to fix the flat tire if you want to, you know, carry the load. So to that end, you know, AEA came up with a study and said, well, there's all these benefits if you guys do all this. And we go, yeah, that's great. Unfortunately, we don't have the business model that supports financially dealing with that problem. It's too big for one utility. Our balance sheets, you know, we're an A-rated company. You know, I can borrow more money, but I still have got to have to be able to get rate recovery for that. And so if I'm fixing transmission, I don't know if I'm going to have rate recovery for it. Nobody's going to lend me the money. So on the other side of the ledger is somebody who's pretty smart saying, what are you going to use the money for, Brad? Well, to fix stuff. Well, who's going to pay for it? I don't know. That's not going to work. I've been there, done that, and worked very hard on getting a rating increase, which we just got, and getting low-cost financing and putting a commercial paper program. So I know a little bit about finance, and I know you better have a darn good business purpose to borrow money. So we have the issue of, well, how would the rail belt fix itself? You know, and then maybe you can get to this thing where you expand it out to some of the areas that were just discussed on the road system and others. And to me, you need to change the business model. That's my opinion. I get pretty good board support for that. I think Chugach Board's pretty forward-thinking. We've been working on this for over a year. We've actually hired people to come in and evaluate, well, how does it work everywhere else and how would it work here? We're not trying to solve the entire problem, but maybe the center hub of the tire or whatever picture comes to mind there. Because we think we need to fix that first and not replicate more of our problems over more geographical area, that we don't think that is a good plan. But fixing what we have is a good one. So we've looked at the business model of the ISO, you know, the independent system operators and the Transco thing, and we're still doing that right now, but we see that there's a possibility that this could fix a lot of problems in the rail belt. Whether or not that can be replicated, first off, whether or not that can even be successfully implemented in the rail belt is a challenge, because you're going to have some people that don't want to play. They don't want to change the model because they have some economic advantage of leaving the model the way it is. So you're going to have resistance and you're going to have leaders. And, you know, that whole thing needs to work itself out. We have some specific things we think could encourage further evaluation in getting this issue here in the rail belt to a point where a business decision could be made. I haven't ripened this enough to bring it into the board and say, here's the X's and O's, or here's the dollars and the cents, and this is why you should do that. We're still trying to get a structure that seems to work. And then we'll drill down and say, okay, now, how do you transfer assets? How do you deal with ownership? How do you deal with the commission and this, that, and the other? So we think that, you know, one way to consider this is light regulatory guidance to give to your subject matter experts, which is the RCA. They know a lot about this stuff. To say, work with the industry and see if you guys can get a model change here that makes sense. Not just fixing what we have as problems, but fixing it so it's the next 100-year model. I don't want a model that, you know, makes me look good for the next year in front of my board or something like that. I want a model that looks good for my grandkids. So you know, that's what Chugach has been up to, and we've been working pretty hard on that. And we do have subject matter experts here, and we have some more information back on the posters and stuff for those that want to stick around and get some more information. But, you know, we'll be happy to come down and talk to the legislature in more detail about the various models that we've seen and how they might apply here. But I, you know, I'll echo something Joe said before, because those of us that are working on it pretty hard realize you have to have a parent in a room, because and that's the ISO, and that you know starts with guaranteeing non-discriminatory open access, reliability standards uniformly implemented, unified transmission tariff, and the potential to have economic dispatch. We see all that good in that, but I can't tell you that I've developed an exact roadmap for how we forklift the rail belt to that. I'm working on it, but you know it's still a lot of work to be done. And there's a lot of differences between Alaska and the lower 48 and why things work down there and why they may not work here. But we're working on that, and to the extent that that can be replicated and you can get microgrids and you can connect more to our grid, I think it starts with fixing, you know, a grid and getting a model that might work. It might work in Southeast. I'm not sure. I see some similarities down there that, you know, maybe an ISO down there kind of makes sense. But we also need to do it light. I think somebody mentioned it before. We don't have millions of customers hooked onto these things, so we have to be careful. For God's sakes, don't do anything to damage my rating. You know, let's not be that, you know, wild and reckless with what you're doing here. You could see there's billions of dollars that have been invested. There needs to be good caretaking of that investment. And yes, we can accommodate change, and yes, we have motivated people in our governance model that want to see change. But it's really difficult sometimes to achieve change. And I'm sure a lot of people in the room here know exactly what I mean when I say that. So, I don't know, maybe I spoke too much, but we're working on it.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you for your leadership. And I tried to say that at the outset. I mean, I appreciate the Gretzky founders and the ArcTech founders and what you're trying to do. And it is a difficult task, and it does require leadership. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, there isn't a cookie-cutter approach to it. But thank you for what you're doing for Alaskans. And, you know, the idea of Southeast, just briefly I'll say, at some point maybe there's an exportation opportunity for hydro as well. You know, there are lots of different things to think about, but we've got to get beyond this first part of it. And so I appreciate what you have to say. I'm going to turn to Joe, then I'm going to go to Representative Tarr, and then let Senator Bishop wrap up.
Real quick, Senator, regarding Representative Isaacson's question, I think the best thing that could be done for the rail belt is to create a robust transmission system. And if you do that, then you have the vehicle there to do everything that Brad just talked about and that Corey mentioned. And that also would open it up to the IPPs for the opportunities that they want to achieve. It makes it rather simple. So the key, I believe, is to create that robust transmission system. And I'll turn it over to the representative.
Senator, may I ask a follow-up question then? And I heard Corey and Brad and Joe, both, all three of them said, we got to build that transmission. How do we pay for that? What's the best way that the legislature and the utilities mind should entertain for funding this so it doesn't hurt the ratings, but it also allows for distributive costs to all people who are using the electricity and the transmission line benefits?
I'll take the first phase of that answer, because it's a complex problem. It's probably not going to necessarily limit to what I think as far as the solution. But, you know, first off, we have to decide, you know, what's the capacity of the rail belt members to pay for transmission. You know, we don't have a model that allows us to do that. I don't have a model. There's not a business model that exists right now in the rail belt that allows every person in the room to put a nickel in. There are some people in the rail belt that are essentially, and I don't mean to disparage people, they do what they have to do and the circumstances are what they are, but they're not paying as much as other people for transmission services. and we don't all behave well in that area. We think, you know, through the analytics of the ISO model, we would find out, well, what is the capacity of the members to help pay for that? I'm not sure it's the $900 million fix that everybody's looking at, but, and first off, that can't happen overnight. But you do need to make sure that if you're going to embark on that, that everybody is contributing to that, not just the person that happens to be the asset owner. I mean, you get just kind of stuck in the middle with a lot of transmission assets, and a lot of people don't want to pay for any of it. So with that model, how are we going to do more of it? It's just clearly broken. We can't even uniformly implement our reliability standards, our operating standards. We have people that don't even agree to those. So without the parent in the room, without the leadership of the board pushing me in this direction, it's not going to happen. You can, you know, basically you should throw the baby out with the bathwater and I'm the baby. You know, if we can't do it ourselves, if we can't work with the commission and present models and present a way forward and let them vet those, we're not going to get there. We need that guidance, and that's a partial answer, because until we know the dollars and cents, I can't answer that question. And I don't believe, my gut feeling tells me we can afford more if everybody's paying into it. The question is, well, how much more? And what would you do if the more amounted to, you know, let's say a $300 or $400 million capital plan? What would we do to fix what we have? And then what would we do for the balance that, you know, it's just all you're doing is driving our rates up, and that seems to be the core problem for everybody in this room is, you know, rates are going the wrong way.
Right.
So the more sand in the truck with a flat tire isn't helping me.
Well, and I'll just add, too, and I know Representative Isaacson, you and I have talked about this, too, that when you think about it as a highway, there certainly is an appropriate role for the state that I feel is there in terms of benefiting consumers. There's a whole lot of money, even from the Southern Rail Belt extension, that was never fully applied to the customers in the region. So I think there's certainly a partnership opportunity there and maybe bonding. But I would believe the RCA would probably look at this issue and have more to say.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, too, because I think it's, you know, I think we have to do our fair share of saying what can we do and not just come down there and say, look at these big problems. Would you please solve these for us, because we can't figure out how to do it. And I think there's a lot of like-minded people in the room that want to see that happen, and I think we're going to push the needle in that direction, and to the extent that gives us a system that, you know, a renewable resource in Fairbanks, maybe they don't have to sell to Golden Valley. Maybe we sell to somebody else. It would be a uniform tariff. So it won't matter. You know, there's a lot of solutions. There's a lot of good benefits that come along from that, not just fixing the known, you know, congestion problems. There's a lot of other benefits that would come along with that. So I think it's fair to ask utilities, well, what can you do? And you should work on this. And I think the commission is the appropriate body to judge whether or not it's a rational a way to apply, you know, maybe some sort of transmission tariff across the system. So I think we have to do it.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Because it's 4 o'clock and I know people do have appointments, I don't mean to curtail debate. I'm going to turn to Representative Tarr and then Senator Bishop and just remind us that the dialogue will continue. I did this in the interim for both the IPPs and the utilities so that we could get a background, we could get the documents and so forth public so that lawmakers could begin thinking. With the 90-day session, it has compressed a lot of the ability to dialogue on these issues. So this gives us all a chance to really start to think about where those questions are for the future. And I want to thank everyone, and I don't want anyone to feel as if I've cut you off. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. And I'll just luckily, a lot of my questions were answered in these last few comments about the Transco and ISO model and how things are moving forward and whether that would be good models to consider for other areas in the state. So to the extent the legislature could facilitate conversations about that, I'd be interested in hearing from folks and finding out ways that we can do that in the goal of, you know, having a better statewide long-term plan to meet our energy needs. So with that, I'll turn to Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Karen. Senator,
Presenters, great job today. It's always a pleasure to hear your comments. And with that being said, I want to help you get where you want to go. I don't want to go, well, I won't go to Juneau 50 years from now, but I don't want to go into my office in Juneau and look in archives at a report that's 50 years old talking about the same thing we're talking about today. I want to help you get where you want to go, starting now. And what a great information this has been today. But there's some things that was said there today that I think we are on our way. You're the experts. You know what you want to do. Where you need us, that's where we fit it in the cog. But some of the things that I heard today, and I'm going to be brief because I know people got to go, but, you know, I think some of this stuff's well on its way. Corey, he addressed the 800-pound gorilla in the room, avoided cost. You know, IPP say they need incremental rates. Well, I go back to my gas pipeline days, and I go, well, that's distance-sensitive rates. You know, that's what they're talking about. There's a docket open. RCA's looking at that. Maybe some of that is going to come to pass coming down the road. And I think I've heard this today, but on these spinning reserves as it relates to wind power and having those spinning reserves, I'm still a big fan of hydro. I think hydro is the gift that keeps on giving, not to kick gas to the curb. I think gas is a great thing, but the minute you put a drill bit in a reservoir, it's got to end its service life date certain. That you got hydro power in Juneau that's been running for over 100 years, every day. 120 years. Okay? We haven't heard a thing about the reserve going away in Juneau on that hydropower. So the spinning, if we had some more hydro, maybe some of these wind projects would be more economical as well and help you all with your spinning reserves not to have those turbines spooled up. So I still would like to see Susitna go forward. Joe, it was great to hear your comments on the ISO and the Transco. I think we're on the way, you know. So, and I agree with you. I don't want to ever forget rural Alaska. That's where most of my roots are. But if this 68% of the rail belt can be affected now, that's where the biggest population group is. Let's start there, and let's take the savings that we get from that and then take that to the bush and start knocking these projects off. But I'd like to see a reasonable approach, too, throughout the state on these energy projects, and let's start knocking them off. So with that being said, I had one. Oh, on your ISO, and Brad did a good job of hitting on part of it, Doug's question, and I had made a note, Joe, when you were talking, under this ISO model, has the economics been ran? Is there a cost-benefit analysis been done? Because, you know, like the Fairbanks Trucking Project that Gene has been working on, I mean, it was when you cut our diesel rates in half by bringing gas to Fairbanks, you know, those are the kind of things that the legislature likes to see that they can get in behind and fund. So, in the comments.
There was a question in there, though. Correct? Am I correct? Has the economics been run?
Right.
Okay. Well, AEA did do a study that looked at if we built out a robust transmission, what could be the economic savings on an economic dispatch basis, and they came up with about $100 million. And I think that was on an annual basis. And there is a lot of benefit to economic dispatch, and it does require a transmission system that's not constrained. And that freed up the full capability of Bradley under that one. And right now, Bradley is constrained. It's capacity constrained, and it's a very lossy system. So there have been economics run, but there have not been detailed economics of how an ISO or an ISO Transco model would work in terms of rates and tariffs and asset ownership and equity and all of those things. Those are very big questions. You start telling people you're going to transfer my assets, I can't do that because I've got debt covenants on my bonds that tell me I can't. So you have to be very careful. So there has to be a melt-up. But, you know, we get that, and we can still accommodate that, but just don't scare my lenders in the process. But we don't have the final answer, but we know there's a lot of benefit out there for that. So that's probably not the exact answer you wanted, but it's the best one we got today.
Excellent. Well, thank you to everyone for being here, and I forgot to acknowledge Senator Gene Cherio as well, who's here from the EA, and thank you for his work. Thank you to everyone, and we look forward to the continuing dialogue.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Excellent roundtable.
That was great. You guys, thank you.
You got it.
Really good.